Hey everyone, I'm your host Michael Nova, and welcome to Rise Up Radio. As an entrepreneur, Mark DeVoe ran several successful businesses and moved on to the music industry, where he released two best-selling albums with his music group, Urban Myth Club. He's performed at the UK's Glastonbury Festival three times and signed a publishing deal with Warner Brothers. And he's also a life coach. Here's our interview with Mark DeVoe. So first of all, Mark, I love the fact that you're a serial entrepreneur just like I am. You've done so many things and are continuing to do many things that interest you. You've had two best-selling albums with your music group, Urban Myth Club. You've had a song chart in the top 30, and you signed a publishing deal with Warner Brothers. And your first ever gig was at the Glastonbury Festival, which is one of the largest musical festivals in the world. Can you tell us a little bit about how your first big career break came about with Urban Myth Club?
Wow, that's a great question, Michael. And I think for me, the biggest thing that happened in terms of breaks, it wasn't really so much anything that happened in the industry. It was actually a moment that I sat at my keyboard one morning, having bashed around trying to write some decent music for a number of years, and having this sense that I wasn't good enough and I'd never be as good as my icons that I listened to. And one day I sat down at my keyboard and I thought, what if today I just pretended I was a recording artist and I could actually do this? It was like this, and it was crazy. Almost like an actor would be given a role. You're a recording artist and you can, you read the script and you think, wow, this sounds like a great role. I'd love to be this, love to play this character. I actually kind of suspended reality, or my own reality, I should say, and thought, I wonder what I could do if I actually tried to write as if I were a successful musician. And something came out of me in that session that was different from everything I'd ever written before. It had a different confidence to it. And I realized from that moment on that the person that shows up to write, and this goes for any artist, whether it's music, painting, writing, whatever it is, the person that shows up to create imprints whatever's in them, into whatever they're creating. So I was always showing up as this person who never quite believed he had what it took to create something that anyone would be remotely interested in. But the moment I suspended my own reality and thought, hey, what if, suddenly it came through and I realized it had been there all along. It had always been inside me, a bit like one of my favorite books, The Alchemist, where the guy goes off on a journey to find what it is he's looking for, and then he realizes that it was with him all along when he returns home. And so that was kind of like the major shift that happened for me in terms of a life shift. And it's something that I've applied in everything that I try to do, because I'm just fascinated by this adventure that we're on in life.
So it's interesting. As soon as you mentioned that, I thought of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, it's kind of a type of therapy, but it's also a way of languaging. Are you familiar with it?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So one of the exercises that I personally do is sometimes to get myself hyped up is like, just pretend that you're Superman and just walk around the room as if you have a long flowing cape on your back, and notice how you hold your body differently, and it just transforms the way you're feeling at that moment. So that's kind of like almost like what you did in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. It was this idea that I find that people are very good, they develop their muscles of worry and their muscles of fear, and they develop their muscles of not being good enough, and they get really good at believing that kind of stuff. And so for many of us, it's a case of actually starting to see that for what it is and switch it. And in a way, if you can kind of snap out of whatever adversity your life is facing based on a lack of belief or maybe a lack of confidence, then everything can change in an instant. I mean, this wasn't something that happened over a period of time. I've been working at my music for a period of time. I'm sure that helped develop my craft, if you like, as an artist. But it was that moment where I gave myself permission to believe and realized that I was the only person that could do that in my life. No one was going to give me a certificate that said, you are now a recording artist. You now have the talent or the gifts or the education to write a song that somebody else would be interested in listening to. I realized I had to first give that to myself. And I think that when people face any challenges in life, the solutions for the way out of that challenge is something that lies within, and it's about them giving themselves permission to maybe see their life differently.
So just to go back to your story for a moment, as I understand it, you formed Urban Myth Club with your writing partner, and kind of your first step after writing your material was to get into Glastonbury. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was. And that was pretty insane, actually. That was a crazy time in my life, because what I had done when I was going through this period of dreaming about what potentially could happen with a music career, it's something I always wanted to follow throughout my whole life. It was something I was passionate about as a kid, and it never, I say music chooses you. You don't choose music. And if you even try to like not do music for a year, it'll still come back into your life and say, you've got to write. And so I wrote a list. I call it my magic postcard. I wrote down 10 of the most insane things I would love to happen with my music career. And at the top of that list was to play Glastonbury. And for people in the UK, very familiar with Glastonbury, it's like the world's biggest festival. It's just the most incredible range of artists each year show up to play. I think about 160,000 people attend the festival. And it was always my dream, and I used to think about it a lot. I used to visualize what it might be like to play there. And I actually held on to that dream as I was writing the music. And what actually kind of happened is, whilst I was writing the music, I was thinking about, if I got that chance, if I were ever to get that chance to play Glastonbury, what kind of music would I like to play? Like, what would I like to see the audience doing? What kind of energy would I like to have in that environment? And so the music I wrote, it was almost like my soundtrack for Glastonbury, if you like, in some ways. And I don't know if that had any impact on what then happens, but usually the way you get to play Glastonbury, if you're ever fortunate enough to have that, is you kind of build a career over 15, 20 years, you build up a big fan base, and then they come knocking. But for us, Glastonbury turned out to be our first ever gig. In fact, it wasn't our first gig, it was our second gig, because our first gig was a warm-up, like almost like a run through our set, just to make sure everything worked, because it was quite a complex setup because of the nature of the band. We had 9 people on stage. We had like a lot of orchestral music. We had dancers, a VJ, percussionists, live instruments, as well as stuff streamed off the computer. So it's a very complex thing that we had to deliver. But in some ways, you've got to be careful what you wish for, because I dreamed of this happening. And when they turned around and offered us a slot, we only had half an hour of music actually written, and they gave us an hour slot. So we had then 3 months to accomplish what we'd done in the previous 2 years, which was to write the second half of the album and find a band and then rehearse. And with those deadlines, insane deadlines, we managed to achieve it. And it was one of the most incredible experiences of my life.
So logistically, as I remember the story, you found out who was booking. You're always a guy, and I've watched, I've listened to interviews that you've done and read some things about you. You're a guy who follows the road less traveled, which I love, my favorite book. So you always advocate doing things differently than everyone else, which I totally believe in and which I've done. So you found out the booker's name who booked one of the stages. Is that correct? The electronic stage?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, you found out who it was. First of all, how were you able to find out who it was logistically?
I'm trying to think back. I think it was as simple as calling at the Glastonbury office and asking the question. Because like no one does that. And they gave me the guy's name and number. And I just thought that was easy. Meanwhile, the other option was entering Battle of the Bands. It was a competition that they were putting on where one band would win a slot at Glastonbury. And I thought, well, we could do that route. But when I looked at it, the way it worked is every region had a kind of semi-final and final, and the winner of that region went on to a larger region, and then eventually accumulated, you know, through many stages, a bit like these shows you see on TV where it would come to the national final and then one of those amazing bands would get the opportunity. Meanwhile, I was like, what happens if I could? I mean, that was the easy bit, because obviously finding the details was great, but then I had to actually bottle up the courage to make the call and send them something. So, and I obviously, you know, a lot of that was kind of in the hands of the gods to some extent, because what then transpired is when we sent the music to this actual booker for this stage, he really loved it. And that's something that I couldn't have, you know, there's always a bit in some ways that fate plays its role. And that was the bit that kind of took me by surprise, because I hadn't really thought through the conversation that was then an offer of a slot. I didn't know what to do beyond that. I'd never been in that position before. So I was kind of, you know, winging it and to some extent, but there's nothing like, you know, that's a great problem to have. And so that it was, and you're so right. The road less traveled is one of my mottos in life, because the way I see it, especially in something like the music industry, and it applies to many things in life, is you can choose to go down Main Street. You know, you can choose to go down the tried and tested path that everyone says, this is how you do something. And when you go down that road, it's a very crowded road, and there are 99.9% of all the people who think this is how you have to do it. But I found that there's always a little alleyway, a little shortcut. And it's not a shortcut which means you have to work any less hard. You know, you still have to put the work and the effort in. But the actual process means that you're not competing with 99.9% of everyone out there. You're competing with the 0.1% of nutters who are crazy enough to do the road less traveled. But you know, when you do the opposite, you're putting the odds in your favor. And that's something that I've done in many ventures that I've experimented with in life. And honestly, it's incredible how it can bring results, and it's exciting as well. I mean, it's, you know, whereas the road less, the main road, if you follow the herd, you end up stepping in poo, right? I mean, that's the general. So that's tiring and it's crowded. So the road less traveled is a much more fun place to be. And you meet people on that road who are incredible as well. You kind of meet your kind of soul brothers and sisters along those shortcuts. And it's a fantastic, fantastic ride.
So I'm curious, when you made that first call, What did you say? You just said, "Hey, I have a band," and I mean, how did that first call go? I know it was a long time ago, but can you recall anything from that?
I realized very early on in my music career that, you know, even though the whole indie music scene was starting to become really huge, you know, in terms of like the music industry starting to break down and there were indie artists who were starting to become successful on their own right, I realized that going out and promoting yourself still had a stigma attached to it. And so I decided from a very early age in the music industry that I was going to set up a record label. And the sole purpose of that record label was to sign ourselves. So rather than go and try and chase, you know, a major label and go through that route, again, the road most traveled, I thought, well, I'll create a record label, sign myself, I'll become the CEO of that record label, and then I'll promote the band. So whenever I went into the music industry world, you know, conferences, and I would often go in as the, you know, label founder, the record label founder. So that's how I approached the festivals. I didn't approach it as I'm a guy in my bedroom making some music on the computer. I went as a guy raving about this incredible new band. and I appreciate this now looking back, it wasn't just me. It would have been very hard to have done that if I were a solo artist and I was having to kind of be almost a schizophrenic person who was bigging up themselves, because that's really hard to do, and I it's not really within my nature to, it doesn't feel right to do that. And I coach a lot of musicians, and they have this, you know, this comes up many times. It's like, how do you promote yourself? It's so hard to kind of try and tell the world how great you are, which just doesn't feel natural. And so I was promoting the band, the outfit, Urban Myth Club. I wasn't promoting me, Mark DeVoe. And that kind of meant that I could again play this role, this character of this record label founder. And what I talked about is how passionate I was about the music. And, you know, it's very important for people that are out there struggling to get their work known by others, is that it's not about selling yourself. It's not about telling people how great you are. It's about selling the passion that you have for what you do. So if you're an author, it's about how excited you are about your book. It's that thing that's not directly part of you. It's that external thing. And it's much easier to then push and promote that. And so it became quite a natural way for me to promote the band. And then, you know, eventually I would do interviews as a band member, and I would talk about that experience, which would be different from the conversations I'd have as a label owner.
So when you made the call, you called as Mark DeVoe, or did you make up an alter ego?
Oh, no, I didn't make up an alter ego. I thought, you know, I just rang as Mark DeVoe. I mean, at the time, the band weren't well known, so the guy I spoke to wasn't thinking, well, hang on, that's the same guy who's in the band. I mean, nowadays, it wouldn't be seen as so different in some ways, because there's many examples of artists out there who are, you know, running the show. You know, Macklemore's one that comes to mind, you know, who've created their own business, their own entity, and they're making it. And so people would expect to be speaking to the main man, as it were. And there's many examples of that. But this was kind of early days when the whole indie music scene was really just getting started. And so it was quite an unusual place to be. But I didn't use a moniker or a pseudonym, because I wanted to be speaking as myself, but just as the record label owner.
Yeah. Do you think that today that would work if the guy goes to your website and sees that, well, Mark DeVoe is the main guy here, and I just spoke to him? You think that would still work, or would that be confusing?
I think it helps in some ways to have representation at some level, because representation means that somebody believes in what you're doing and is willing to spend their time promoting what you're doing. And that in itself brings a level of professionalism, if you like, or value, external value to whatever it is that's being promoted. So I think that it's good. I mean, when I coach musicians, I often say to them, even if they, you know, they're thinking, well, I don't have a PR agent or a booking agent, and I say, well, do you have a friend that loves your stuff and is passionate and is a good talker on the phone? Well, ask them to get involved and help you, like, bring them into your dream, you know, declare your dream to them and get them excited, and maybe they can take you to the next place that you want to go to. So there's always ways. I love the idea of, you know, sharing the passion and sharing the dream with a team. I coach around this idea of a dream team. You know, it's one person's, in the solo artist case, there's one person's name, like Adele or Ed Sheeran, on the cover of the album, but there's a cast of thousands in the thank you list in the album credits. And, you know, it's always about who are the people that can help support you, and in by doing so, you know, fulfill their own dreams of doing what it is that they most are passionate about in life. If that's promoting an artist, for example, or creating art for an artist, you know, branding side of things that they then get to put out into the world. So it's how you as a team can all move forward and all live each other's dreams through each other and what you're doing.
So you've had obviously a lot of success in the music industry, but let's talk a minute about the flip side. Can you talk about sometimes that you've had in the music industry where you encountered adversity that you've had to overcome? Can you talk a little bit about maybe something specific that you ran up against and how you overcame it?
Oh, absolutely. Where to start? I mean, one of the best stories, the one I most love, which is actually it's quite funny as well, is that after Glastonbury, we got booked for the Big Chill Festival. And the Big Chill Festival is more of a, I mean, I say a boutique festival, it's still like 30, 40,000 people, but it was more an electronic based festival rather than Glastonbury kind of covers all genres of music. But we were on a big stage. I mean, we were on a huge stage and we're playing, I think, to 5 or 10,000 people, which, you know, as a second gig was pretty, in itself, you know, was, you know, it's something I wasn't used to doing. And so two things happened just before we were meant to go on. The whole stage, the power just went out. And we're an electronic band. Like, we had everything plugged in, stuff fired up, booted up, and everything went dead. So instantly we started to panic. But then they had a generator kick in, which was kind of cool because we then had this, you know, percussive rumbling in the back of our track. Fortunately, they got the everything working before we went on live. But I was so thrown by that. I was so nervous. I had to run to the toilet. And I shot out the back of the stage and there were some Portaloo cabins, these kind of lovely, you know, toilets, temporary toilets that you get at festivals, and big plastic kind of Doctor Who TARDIS boxes. And I went in there and anyway, was having a bad time in there. I shouldn't give you too many details. But when I was all sorted, I went to open the door and the door was jammed. And it was like literally shut solid. And then I heard, "Ladies and gentlemen, Urban Myth Club," and the crowd going, "Wah!" And I was like, "Oh my gosh." And I started pounding on this door. And of course, no one could hear me because the band had started playing the music. It was like massively loud. I mean, the Portaloo was probably shaking slightly because I was in there trying to get out. And I eventually karate kicked this door, almost breaking my foot, and managed to burst it open. But then I came running up the back of, there's a ramp at the back of the stage where they'd bring all of the kind of, you know, long ramp where they bring all the heavy equipment. I came sprinting up there and I made this grand entrance about 2 minutes into the first track. And my whole band looking at me thinking, "What the hell are you doing? Like, that wasn't in the rehearsal." And it looked like I was trying to have this big ego moment where I was like, "And it's me," you know. And but nobody knew. Nobody knew that I was trapped in the toilet. And honestly, at one point, I thought I wasn't going to get out. And then the other thing that happened in that, so this was just all in one hour set. Our vocalist had decided to stay up the night before because her favorite artist, Rosine Murphy, was headlining on the Friday night. And she had stayed up and it got quite cold and she was singing her heart out. And she woke up the next morning with a very sore throat and could barely speak. And Claire is this beautiful singer. She's got this angelic voice. But she said, I don't think I can do it. And we just said, "You have to do it. There's some way." So she said, "The only way I can do it is probably sing in a lower register, like an octave lower." And so what was really interesting is for the very first time ever, we were playing live on stage, listening to the vocals sung an octave lower of this angelic, sweet girl sounding like, you know, Rod Stewart. But at the same time, it really worked. She pulled it off. And everyone went and bought the CD and they were like, what is this? This isn't what we heard. We want the low vocals. So yeah, that was one example of adversity. The other one, which was huge actually, that almost meant the whole band disbanded before we even got going, was that the same singer, Claire, she signed to that the week before we were releasing the album, having worked with her for 2 years, she'd worked with another band. And this other band happened to get, their star came up and they happened to get signed by EMI the week before we were putting our album out. And I got a phone call from EMI's lawyer saying, "Oh, we hear that you've used Claire on some of your tracks." Well, like half of them. And they said, "Yeah, you can't put any of that stuff out." And I said, what do you mean? And they said, "Well, you know, you can't do that because we're putting a huge amount of money into the band and we don't want two singles in the charts at the same time that would confuse the listener." And so I was staring into the abyss thinking, you know, what do I do? I do, you know, I don't have a, you know, do I need representation? Is there a way around this? Are they, you know, BSing me? So that was probably the low point, and that would have just, everything would have imploded if that had been the case, like that we couldn't have actually released any of the material with her. And yeah, I remember that being a pretty stressful time, because you get to a point where you put so much of your life into something, and then to hit something like that, where you just think somebody else can just say, nope, not happening. Yeah, was a pretty low point, but we got through it. We got through it. And, you know, and we're working with Claire again now, funnily enough. So yeah, it's all good. It's all good.
So they allowed you to put out the material, or you got another vocalist?
No, it wasn't a case of that. I mean, we worked with multiple vocalists anyway. It just happened that we had Claire on the majority of the album. It turns out that actually, you know, that the lawyers were just trying to scare us, because they didn't want us releasing. It was a bit of a play, and you know, a couple of months down the road, we discovered that, you know, they couldn't really stop us. So we just put everything out. It was fine, but you come up against some of those things, you know, in the music industry, and it can be challenging. But yeah, it was an interesting time.
Yeah, also outside the music industry, you were diagnosed at the age of 25 with an incurable disease, which no longer affects you. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, I was diagnosed with, I'd always had back problems, you know, as a kind of a late teen, and they wouldn't go away. And I got diagnosed with something called ankylosing spondylitis, which is a disease of the, I mean, some people, you see some people have it, their whole spine becomes solid and bent over, and it can be a real massive disability. And it was something that I discovered when I was 25. And obviously to discover I had that was huge, because it kind of affected my outlook for the rest of my life. I saw all the horror stories of how some people end up disabled, can't drive. But you know, within it all, the blessing is incredible. You know, when I went to see the doctor, they said to me, the best thing that you can do to kind of keep this at bay and stop it from developing is exercise. And I thought, well, how incredible that I get the disease, where the diagnosis and medicine is, you got to exercise, you got to get out there and keep fit. Because I'm thinking, well, you know, there's so many people get diagnosed with such, you know, terrible things, which, you know, they don't have a choice about how to kind of deal with it, but they still didn't know very much about it at the time, and they're still trying to discover more about it. But through what I think the biggest change for me was, I decided not to own it. So when people said to me, have you got it, you know, have you got this thing, or what's this thing that you've got, I never owned it. I never labeled myself as actually having it, even though the doctors would tell me I'm a patient and I have this disease. I chose a few years later, having dealt and suffered with it and thought, no, this isn't what I want to be. I realized that I was becoming the problem, you know, in my mental attitude. And I realized that if I chose not to believe again, kind of almost the reverse of the story about me becoming a recording artist, if I chose not to believe that I had it, would that change anything? And something again incredible happened. Every time somebody said, oh, how's it going? And I say, oh, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. And it almost took away the power of it. And, you know, on the other side, I was keeping fit. I started doing yoga, which was again a blessing to discover yoga through the illness, which I now love. And I do, you know, every day if I can. But it was again letting go of this idea, because, you know, you are not your body. You're not your disease. I'm speaking to a man who knows this more than anyone else. I mean, you've got one of the most incredible stories. So for me, it was this case of just realizing that this body that I have is a vehicle that I've been given in this life. And for sure, it's going to have things wrong with it. And it's going to need servicing every now and again. I'm going to try and have to look after it, and it's going to age, and it's always aging. But recognizing that I am not that thing. And in fact, I've had a situation, someone very close to me had cancer. And when people asked us about the disease, they say, oh, you have cancer. And the response would always be, no, my colon has cancer. I don't have cancer. I'm cool. And it's a separation of the physical, right? Because if you own cancer, if you have cancer, then you become cancer, then you fight cancer as if it's an enemy to you, as opposed to making peace with it, because it's just part of your body that has, and I don't say this flippantly, because I realize there's a lot of people out there that are suffering. And if you know, for anyone listening to this that is dealing with cancer, my hope is that this inspiring story that I witnessed as someone supporting someone through cancer who went through chemo and did everything and is now 5 years clear, that I saw that moment, that separation of, I don't have cancer. My colon has cancer and we're having to look after that. And we're going to have to try and make that better. But I am not owning that disease. It is not who I am. And I'm not going to give it the power to become part of my life in that way. And it's not pushing it away and saying, I just don't want to pretend it's there. It's recognizing that an organ in your body is suffering and needs love and needs help and needs kindness and needs nurturing and needs kind thoughts, not fighting, going to war with it, seeing it as the enemy. It's part of your body. It's the cells that have gone bad in your body and they need to be healed. So in some weird way, that kind of very early story of me saying, I am a recording artist, I give myself permission, started to lay the foundations for some of the, helping me through some of the biggest challenges in my life in terms of letting go of stuff and not labeling myself as something. So it's very, very powerful. And my hope is that people can kind of tap into their own inner strengths and awareness of that in their own lives. Because as human beings, we are phenomenal things, right? We take it for granted because we just see each other every day. It's like, oh, there we are waking up, the same me in the mirror. And we look at our spouses or partners or kids and we're saying, there are kids doing these things. But like if we saw a dog jump on a bike on YouTube, we're like, wow, check that out. Yet when we send a guy up to space, we're kind of so blasé about it. But at our core, we are incredible beings that can do amazing stuff. If only we remember that and we remember this nature that we have and this blessing called life, which we all have if we're breathing. So, yeah, it's an incredible ride.
Right, so your what if scenario of your imagining, you know, your career as you want it to be in visualization, which I know you're big on, you applied that to your health as well.
And I think that it can be applied to pretty much everything in our lives. It's a much more positive way to focus on what you would like to create in your life rather than focusing on the potential problems that you have or could have if you tried something.
Which leads us very neatly into my next question, which is that you are also a life coach. One of the things that you do is help musicians with the music industry, but you also are a life coach for people outside the music industry, right? So how did you, what made you make that transition from being a musician to becoming a life coach? What got you into that?
I think from a very early age, I became really fascinated by the nature of human beings and why we do the things we do and why we do the crazy things we do as well. And I started reading. Like my dad gave me a book when I was 15, which changed my life because it suddenly showed me a kind of different side to thinking as a human being. And so I've always been fascinated in it. And I found I was naturally drawn to But people were naturally drawn to ask me questions about life, and we got into very deep conversations, as we are here. It's quite rare for we can't really have a conversation without going deep. I just this is what I love. I love to explore life and all its wonders and mysteries. And so I became very well read in everything I could get my hands on to do with human potential, personal development, spirituality, you know, just the whole gamut. And I always had this natural desire to want to help people. And then I'd started doing a radio show in England, actually, around this concept of 4,000 Saturdays, which was my own take on life. 4,000 Saturdays is the average number of Saturdays we have in a lifetime. And I became fascinated by the journey that we have through, you know, we only have so much time to try and achieve and do the things that we would like to leave as a gift to the world. And I realized that through the journeys that I've been on, through setting up businesses within the music industries, my latest project is attempting to write a best-selling book in 52 weeks, which I'm doing with a friend, and we're documenting the whole thing on a podcast called The Bestseller Experiment. And that's kind of hysterical because we're interviewing all these amazing authors and actors like Bryan Cranston and Michael Connelly. So it was one of these things where I was getting all these experiences and I thought, wow, I'm learning so much. I want to share this with people. So even though I'm a life coach, I kind of see myself as much as a mentor or a teacher as well, because I tend to like to guide people based on the experiences I've had. And, you know, I picked up a few clients who were interested in working with me. And then that whole side of things just grew and grew until it became quite a large chunk of my week. And I do it because I love it. I love to see breakthroughs in individuals. I love to see the changes that I have experienced and beyond that in other people. And in some ways, it's, I guess, what I was born to do in some ways. I feel it's very very much a part of my reason for being here, mm-hmm. is to kind of help and guide others. So that's really how it happened. It wasn't really ever planned. It kind of just organically grew, not effortlessly, that's probably the wrong word, but I think if you're following your passion, if you're doing something passionate, then people are naturally come to support you through that, and then in return you can support them.
Yeah, that sounds very familiar, because that's what happened with me in Rise Up 8. I certainly didn't plan it, and never imagined that I'd be doing this, but the road took me here.
Yeah, it chose you, right?
Yeah. That's true. So and you're also a speaker. You've been interviewed over 500 times on national TV, radio, newspapers, magazines. How were you able to break into that?
Well, that was, again, it was something that wasn't planned. I think through the various crazy projects that I've started, and you know, I've done things from setting up websites that have become big businesses in the 90s, to the music, to this podcast that we're currently doing. And what I find is that often I'm kind of like the David and Goliath situation. I like to see a situation where I like to try and imagine what I feel is completely impossible in my life, and then try it on and see if I can actually even remotely get anywhere near it. And I think that story is something that appeals to journalists. They love to hear that story about, you know, for example, in my property business that I set up in the mid-90s, I decided to take on the whole of the UK real estate business, the industry, which is a multi-billion dollar or pound industry, by setting up a website called HouseWeb, which is a place where people can buy and sell property direct without the need of a realtor. And so the press loved that. It was like, oh, someone's taking them on. It's like, and so they reached out, and I would get phone calls constantly from, you know, the Sunday Times, the Financial Times, TV shows, and did a ton of interviews there. And then when I moved into the music industry, the same thing happened. It was the story about, well, how did, as a band, we got airplay out in North America before we broke in our home country of England. And people were like, well, how does that happen? How do you do that? And so, yeah, it's, again, it was never something that I pushed. I guess people reached out, and I've done a lot of radio work, which I love. I love to do radio. It's a lot of fun. And I just really enjoy this medium as well of, you know, I get so inspired by reading other people's stories, interviews about other people. So for me, just to be able to kind of do these kind of interviews is great fun, you know, in some ways just paying it forward if anyone gets anything of value from it.
For all the musicians out there, one of the main issues is with so many, you know, it used to be a completely different paradigm in the music industry where you'd get signed to a major label and either you get signed or you don't. You get discovered or you don't. But now it's almost completely the opposite, where anyone can get an audience, and there's so much competition. Everyone's a musician. There's so much competition on the internet. So how does someone break through all the noise and stick their head up like a gopher, you know, one gopher out of millions of gophers sticking their heads out of their holes? How do they get, you know, noticed and amongst all that noise, all the competition?
Yeah, there's a wonderful duality that's happening, which you summed up beautifully there, Michael, in that there's more opportunity than there ever has been in the music industry today, but there's also more competition. And
the blessing is a curse.
The blessing is
or
a curse.
Or vice versa.
Exactly.
Or so, vice versa.
Yeah. And I think, you know, from my perspective, it's the same business as usual, which is do the opposite, the road less traveled. It's a case of looking at what everyone is currently doing. And you have to get creative. I mean, it's not something that you can just kind of like sit and say, I'll do this. You know, I sometimes sat there for hours brainstorming and drawing mind maps and analyzing and playing with the ideas. But whilst everyone is going down what they feel is the route where success leads, there's always the opposite. So you say, what is everyone doing and what would be the opposite of that? And then you get really creative. You know, so I've seen... you know, in some ways, your destiny is in your own hands now with the music industry, whereas before, somebody else decided whether you were young enough, beautiful enough, had good enough hooks and lyrics to become a big-selling artist. You know, those were the guys who ran the major record labels. Now, you just have to decide whether you're going to do it. The test is, are you willing to get over adversity? Are you willing to have those... to have go through those failures, which will come, and multiple failures until you actually reach a point where you see success? And are you willing to get up in the morning, be passionate about what you do, and go out there and make it happen? And that is that's the difference I see in people I coach. The people that succeed are the people who have the passion and belief, regardless of what's happened in the industry in the last 20 years. You know, those people will thrive in this industry because there is, you know, we don't even know what's going to happen in the next 5 years, let alone the next 50 years. We're in one of the most disruptive times, which is a great opportunity. And, you know, it's up to us to kind of define how we want the music industry to look in the future. In some ways, I think people will be looking back on this era that we're in right now as the kind of new age where some of the right and the wrong ways to do things were being tested out and tried out. So we all get to play in that field. The most important thing is if you love what you do and you keep doing it and you keep pushing it, it's about making sure that enough people know about what you're doing. You know, it's not a case of just releasing something on the internet as an MP3 and hoping someone discovers you. You've got to go out and push it. And you've got to dedicate at least part of your day to making that, you know, moving that forward and just keep chipping away and chipping away and chipping away. And eventually the break will come. And when that happens, then depending on what the break is, you then get the momentum and the multiplier effect, which is like what we happened for us with Glastonbury and, you know, radio airplay, and it, things trigger other things. So you have to get very clear about what it is that you want to achieve with your career. Like, what is it that you want to do? And keep that very much in focus for everything that you spend your time doing, so that you are completely focused on that goal of what you want to happen and not get sidetracked. Because that's the other challenge. With opportunity comes distraction. And the internet is a weapon of mass distraction, right? I mean, you could lose yourself for days and weeks to come out and resurface and realize you haven't actually done anything apart from read lots of Facebook posts and cool stuff. But, you know, so do the work, get focused, you know, and keep your eye on the prize. But at the same time, always remember that what you're doing is not for you. It's, I always say to my coaching clients, you know, your gift, your talent in music or whatever it is that you have is something that you must get out and share with the world, because that's why you're here. And you will inspire other people and change their lives by living your passion. And by doing that, you're kind of living your life at its fullest. And I think that's ultimately why, you know, if we look on our deathbeds and we look back over our life, that's the one thing I think that will be a life well lived rather than a life regretted. Because life is a fleeting blink in the eye of the universe. You know, it doesn't last that long, despite how long it can feel sometimes. We don't have much time when you take away all the stuff that we have to do every day. You know, the stuff we have to do, like washing and cleaning and eating and sleeping, is a fairly big chunk of our life. When you actually look at what you've got left in the day to live your dream and inspire others, it's a very small percentage of your life. So we have to get really focused about what it is we want to do with that time, because it's a blessing that we really can't afford to waste.
Yeah, I always like to say that don't look at adversity as the enemy, look at it as an ally, because it actually strengthens you to be able to get onto the next level. So,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I'm sure you've seen it many times, Michael, that every amazing story often starts with adversity.
Yeah. Well, that's why we have all the stories of everyone, all the motivational videos out there telling stories about how this guy was a failure as a young man. And then, you know, I just saw I just saw a video recently on Colonel Sanders, how he started the KFC, I think in his 60s or something like that.
Yeah.
Had many failures before. So speaking of adversity, we only have a few minutes left. So let's delve into your thinking man's approach to adversity. Speaking from one person who knows a lot about the subject to another, what is your philosophy personally about, you know, when you look back on your journey, what have you learned about overcoming adversity in life? Just like our phrase, fall down seven times, rise up eight.
Yeah, it's a brilliant question. I feel that adversity is a bit like being on a roller coaster, and adversity is when you're at that real low. And the great news is that when you hit rock bottom, there is nowhere else to go apart from up. And I do feel that in some ways our lives are defined by those moments. I sit around the table with my kids, we have a family meal together, and they come back from school, and I ask them each individually, how did you fail today? And I ask them to like tell me, and then we celebrate, because every failure that they have tells me that they're trying. They're willing to push themselves beyond their comfort zones. They're willing to screw up and come out the other end and be stronger for it. You know, through failure, through adversity, we learn the most. We learn so much about who we are. And, you know, we often don't make those mistakes again. So adversity is our greatest teacher in some ways. And I think the most key thing, you know, when you look at your life is those moments where you hit rock bottom, everyone, no one's immune to this. There is no one on this planet that has a life that's just like a, you know, flat line. Well, that would mean you're dead anyway, or just a life full of highs. It's a bit like, you know, the saying that if you don't experience darkness, you can't enjoy the light. And I think the same is true in adversity. If you don't experience adversity and failure, you can't appreciate the good times. You can't appreciate the highs and the successes. And it's part of life's rich tapestry. Whenever I fail at something, I know that I'm one step closer to succeeding. And so even though it sucks and it's never feels good to fail, I kind of look at it and think, bring it on. Because if I'm not failing, I'm not living, I'm not trying, I'm not exploring, I'm not growing. And so it's really one of the most crucial things in life that we can all celebrate. You know, so when my kids say, yeah, I screwed up, I did this, I'm like, that's great. And what did you learn from that? Well, I learned X, Y, and Z. And you see them growing before your very eyes. So we should celebrate failure. We should give out awards for the greatest failures, you know, because those people are the most courageous people in the world. And those people are the people who have all the wisdom. And those are the people that can inspire us the most in our own journey and also show us the way, right? Because, you know, like before us, there are many people who've suffered adversity before we showed up. And it's because of their failings. It's because of the Beatles who, you know, tried to sign to every single label they got rejected from. It's J.K. Rowling who, you know, got rejected from every single major publisher before somebody took a punt on her. It's those people that you look to in your life when you're at rock bottom and say, if they did it, if that's the pathway they had to take, then I'm on the right path.
Yeah, I love that. What failure did you have today? I really love that, especially for kids. I think that's wonderful that you're doing that with your kids. You know, when we face adversity, it's like, you know, I like to say that it's like you're in the forest and you're in a dark forest. You can't figure out the way out. But when you finally do get out, you can look back on it and you could say, oh, now I understand. Now that I'm on this new road, I could understand that I wouldn't be on this road if I didn't go through the forest. So I ask you, Mark, if you didn't go through the adversity that you went through, would you be in the same place that you are now in your life where you're helping other people, you're happy with your life, you feel fulfilled in your life? If you didn't go through that adversity, would you be here?
I think that the richness of the life that I have, that I appreciate so dearly, is defined by those moments. I think if I had never experienced those moments, if I'd never, you know, stepped outside my comfort zone, then my life would just feel, you know, if you think about an amp, it would, you know, I feel like I'm living on like 11 right now. Turn my life up to 11 in everything I try and do. And if I hadn't have done that, I think my life would have been a 1. You know, it'd have been very quiet. I maybe wouldn't have been in a position to teach or feel I had any knowledge to teach others because I hadn't experienced anything. You know, my whole coaching philosophy is it never should come from a book. It should never come from a theory. It should come from your own personal experiences. So go out there, fail, then succeed, and then help the next generation that are coming through who are going to experience the same journey. So yeah, absolutely. I think the adversity for me has been a huge defining moments in my life. And in some ways, I look back on all of those things that happened and I'm grateful for them. as weird as that might sound, I'm grateful for those moments because, you know, I wouldn't have known it at the time, but the things that have come out of it have been truly incredible. And for that, you know, you have to see adversity and failure as a blessing.
Yeah. So what about people? It just occurred to me, people sometimes will think, yeah, well, you know, I'm afraid to take that chance. I'm afraid of rejection. I'm afraid of failing. What would you say to people like that?
I'd say brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Because if you're not afraid, you're not about to step outside your comfort zone. You have to feel that fear. I jokingly always say that when I, you know, unless I'm running to the toilet, then I'm not pushing myself. Do you know what I mean? It's like when I make those phone calls, I remember it really well. I was like, I'd be running to the loo because I'd be so nervous, so scared about what I was about to do. And it's a bit like the analogy I think of is someone who's about to do a bungee jump. Like, you know, it's completely crazy and you know you shouldn't be doing it. And you know that the bungee could snap and you know that you could possibly die. Mm. But there comes a point where you just have to let instinct and intuition take over and just take that step and trust. And trust that you'll survive that moment. Because if you live in fear all your life, if you let fear rule you and rule your decisions, then you'll only be teaching others how to live in fear, including your kids if you have them, and it all gets passed down, you know. But for me, the number one thing for me, Michael, is that I want to look back on my life and ask this one question on my deathbed: did my life in any way inspire my kids? And if I honestly couldn't say yes to that question, then I realized that I hadn't been living my truest life. And so it's a very personal question that I check in with even when I want to make a decision about what to do next or some other project. Like, will this inspire my kids? Will this help my kids in some way? Because it becomes personal then. And I know that my kids are going to go through fear and adversity, and one of the greatest skills that we can learn in life is how to take that step and jump off that ledge, even when it feels scary. Because the exhilaration that comes from taking that leap and that jump is ultimately the thing that defines us as a human being. It's the human spirit in its purest form.
I love it. So what's next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, Urban Myth Club, we haven't released anything in a couple of years, but we're working on new material, so there's something to look out for there. I'm also working on this novel. I've never written a novel before, and I've always wanted to, so I've hooked up with a guy who created a Hollywood movie and then wrote a book of the movie, and we're doing this weekly podcast called the Bestseller Experiment. We get to talk with multi-million selling authors, asking about how they do it. And that's become quite a big part of my life. And it's got a really great following, a lot of people getting inspired by that. And so we're releasing this novel in October as indie authors to see if we can get it in the charts, just to see what's possible on that front and what comes from that. And I'm also about to launch a music academy. So musiclifecoach.com, which is my website for all of my music coaching work. I've been developing a number of courses, which I've been running. I've got around 6,000 students now, but I'm bringing it all together onto my website. So that's going to be launching very shortly. So there'll be loads of courses around everything from the business of music through to all the stuff we talked about today, which is the psychology and the belief and all of that stuff's going to be in there. So I hope that will be a really useful resource for people who have a dream of you know, taking their music career further. And my kind of longer term dream is just to write books in this personal development space in the spirituality world, do more talks around that. And I see kind of as I grow older and maybe learn a few more things. I'd love to continue to share that with people. So I'll starting to put out some nonfiction books over the next couple of years as well about many different areas of life. And so, yeah, it's the journey and adventure continues.
That's great. Thank you, Mark DeVoe, for joining us on Rise Up Radio.
Great. Thanks so much, Michael, and brilliant on everything that you're doing at Rise Up. Hey, it's so amazing.
Thanks, Mark. If you know someone who has an inspiring story that we should interview, please email us at info@riseup8.org. I'm Michael Nova, and thanks for joining us on Rise Up Radio.